Welcome to the Adventure Queen podcast number 5, I think we're on right now.
It's my lucky number.
Is it your lucky number? Yeah. Amazing. And we are in the most probably appropriate place for a rower. We're on the Putney Embankment, well, just off it, with one Miss Laura Penhall. Hello, Adventure Queen Laura.
Hello, Mrs.
How are you this evening?
I'm very good. It's a lovely evening.
It is. We're going to contend with some planes going over the top. Now, Laura is a record-breaking Pacific rower. And she's going to be telling us all about that. But first of all, let's go right back to the beginning. Can you tell me where all this madness started? What was the moment where you decided you wanted to go and row an ocean?
Do you know what? The initial moment was lying in my bed in Putney. So same house I'm in now.
Yeah.
And about 5 years ago now. And I get a good old Facebook. I get a message from one of my good mates that I went and did a ski season with. And I got this message through, and basically Leah said to me, "Hey mate, I know you're looking for something crazy to do. You've been looking for a big challenge. Well, I've just heard about this girl that wants to put together a team to row across the Indian Ocean. Do you fancy it?" And that was it. And then she said, "By the way, I'm away now for 2 weeks, so I'll speak to you about it when I get back." And I was like, "No, don't wait for 2 weeks. Tell me now. I want to know now." And do you know what? That was the absolute igniter for me. I remember the next day, walking out of my house and down Putney Hill, and I can see it now, and I was just like, oh my god, this has to happen. You've got to make it happen.
Yeah, so you were that excited.
I was really excited, yeah.
So how did it then go from rowing the Indian Ocean with that girl to actually rowing the Pacific with 5 others?
It's a massively evolved project, and when I got involved with Annie, who had set that team up at the start, when we looked at it, kind of, there was already a female crew that had just rowed the Indian Ocean. And so when we sort of started to speak to Tony, who was our onshore support, and he kind of helped to sort of manage the expedition and sort of write the route, basically, that we were going to do, we sort of had a chat to him. We knew the Atlantic had been done. We knew then the Indian had been done. So, of course, I posed a question about the Pacific.
He was just like, an innocent question.
Well, just, you know, just like, that's the other ocean, isn't it? My geography's not too sharp.
But it's wet.
Yeah, exactly. It's the sea. Yeah, and so he said, well, actually, interestingly enough, no, there hasn't been a force boat that's ever gone across the Pacific, and certainly not an all-female crew. So actually, if you did this, you'd be able to set 2 world records. It wouldn't have to be a speed event. It's just a case of completion. And then initially he was like, you know, you could go from San Francisco to Hawaii. There's a race that's just about to start, New Ocean Wave Race with Chris Martin that was setting up. And so he suggested that. And then I looked at it and I was like, well, yeah, but that's a third. I can't say I'm rowing the Pacific and only do a third of it.
So you immediately looked at the Pacific and went, well, I've got to row the whole way across.
Yeah, so I was like, went back to Tony and said, well, is this going to be doable? Could we row all of it? He said, well, I think you're going to have to do stops to you won't be able to carry all your food, but yes, in essence, it would take you about 6 months. So I was like, well, 6 months is doable. So hence then, yeah, that's where it all started to snowball.
And when you're going through that process of going, you know, someone sends you an email and you immediately get excited about rowing an ocean, first of all, and then you start questioning about a bigger one.
Yeah.
Are there any fears or alarm bells going off in your head, or are you just pushing them aside because you're so excited?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm trying to think. I think the problem with me is that I'm kind of all or nothing. So when I get my teeth stuck into something and I get really focused and think, oh my God, I can make this happen, and what the opportunities are and what... yeah, just what the scope is, it's like a beaming light, and I just want to go towards it the whole time.
So there's almost no time to actually think about being frightened.
And I kind of, you know, occasionally, there were definitely many a time during that whole process of getting to the start line that there were loads of things that, you know, obviously the girl that had originally started the idea of rowing the Indian, and it developed into Pacific after working together for about a year, you know, things got postponed. We thought it was only going to take a year. Ended up, we need to postpone it. And then kind of during that time, like, things just got overwhelmingly bigger and bigger and bigger. And you just need, it just makes so much, you've got to make such a life commitment towards it.
Yeah.
And so it was really difficult sort of when, Annie had to sort of leave the team. And then, so that's when we restructured it and we started as Cox's crew, and I re-recruited and started afresh basically at that stage.
So how many times did you move the start date back? Because I remember what I vaguely knew you.
Yes.
And I remember, I think I was probably the second time I watched you maybe. But how many times did it actually change?
Three. Third time lucky.
So
that's
you were prepared
totally
to,
what I thought.
So 3 years in a row you were prepared to go, to leave your job, friends, family and go over the ocean, and 3 times it fell through.
And it would always be, so that there was a weather window. We had to leave around, like between April and June really, from San Francisco. So Christmas always felt like, right, okay, this is like the last Christmas before we go.
Yeah.
So every Christmas got more and more emotionally difficult. And, you know, the hardest thing is what you're putting your family through and kind of seeing them like each year just getting more and more worried about it or sort of, you know, drawn into it more.
Yeah.
That was the hardest thing. So I used to kind of find going home, it would suddenly make things really emotional, whereas when I was away from home I could crack on, stay focused, I felt like I only had myself to worry about, whereas then you get home you're like, oh, actually I should think about my parents a little bit more than what I do.
There a point in those, because it took you 4 years in total to get to the start line then?
Yeah, exactly.
Was there a point in those 4 years where as a team lead you thought, I'm done, like, I'm going to walk away?
Yeah, there are a few times, to be honest, when you know, people had left the team and we sort of, you know, it was back either only myself or one other. It definitely made me question, and kind of when Annie left, that was really difficult because, I mean, fundamentally it was her original idea to row an ocean. So that, I was completely thrown and massively distraught about, well, what on earth is this all about? Why am I doing this? And because it all got really sort of messy, and it was like, hang on, what's this all about? And so it makes you definitely ask yourself, like, that deep-rooted question. And that's what kind of then drove me forward. It's like, well, I know we can do this. I know we can achieve this. And I kind of also, in my heart of hearts, I would always say to myself, well, you know what? And that's why I did it, like, gave it 3 times. It was on the 3rd time lucky to do recruitment and stuff with getting the girls together. So I was like, you know what, I've just got to give this one last go because I'll never be able to live with myself if I don't. And it was the sort of thing where I said, well, there's going to be an all-female crew one day that will do this. So what is the difference between them making it happen and me? Like, what am I doing wrong? Or what do I need to change to sort of get this team right? And that was the kind of final point where I was like, right, I've got to make this happen. Let's do the right recruitment. Let's get the advice in, get some external people in to help, because maybe I'm just too blinkered with it and actually need to step back and get some external opinions. And yeah, and that sort of made it happen, thank God.
Thank God.
Otherwise, I'd be like, most probably still in my bed watching movies and eating ice cream right now.
Watching Castaway.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's go right to the start of the row now. Let's fast forward. You've raised the spondoolies. You're out there.
Yeah.
And you're pushing off. You're rowing away from the bank.
Yeah.
Rowing away from the bank the first time.
Yes.
How do you feel?
So, 2 a.m. in the morning, pitch black, we had to leave at that sort of time, and all we had was our family on the dockside, and it just felt really surreal. It felt like we were just going off for a little training row. It didn't feel like we were actually rowing out until we then went underneath the Golden Gate Bridge and we started to see the lights sort of disappear in the distance. And at that point I remember just thinking, oh my God, we're finally here, we're finally doing this. All this planning and preparation, the amount of emotion and flipping tears that I've cried. Yeah. I'm not the most teary person, but Jesus. And it really made me think, okay, this is it. All we've got left now is about 6 months. Get this done and it's over with. And that sort of sense of like serenity and just complete, do you know what, relief to a certain extent?
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's no more emails and chasing people and, you know, needing to get people to be involved. Like, everybody was there in the boat. And I knew the other girls were ready and stuff to kind of join us later on. So, yeah, massive sense of relief, massive sense of excitement. Obviously, there was the emotion initially with saying goodbye to the folks, more the fact that I was worried for them on what they thought rather than...
Yeah,
I knew
course.
That we would be all right, but, you know, it's what they think.
I love that. We're in across the Pacific for 9 months. I know we'll be all right.
It's
fine. Don't worry. Right. Chill, Mum. Chill. What's your beef?
Yeah.
So talk to me about rowing an ocean, because I've promised my mum I'll never do it, but I may go back on that one.
I so tried to get you in the boat.
I know you did. And I was I was doing something.
You were running or cycling.
I was running or cycling or something. Yeah, but either way, like, it does appeal to me because of what people say about the serenity out there.
Yeah.
But it's also pretty frightening. So what are the highlights of rowing an ocean for the, like, dummy's guide for rowing the Pacific?
Okay. Highlights. For us, I mean, we've never laughed so much in all our life. And I think that was definitely because of the team dynamics we had on the boat. The girls were just awesome. And so literally, like, tears of complete hysteria of laughter.
Yeah.
Marginally, or majority, should I say, because we were massively sleep deprived. And so most probably what we were hysterically laughing about wouldn't have made any sense to anybody else.
Yeah.
So that was part of it. The other thing, the wildlife, without a doubt, going across the Pacific, I think we were really fortunate to kind of see huge amount of wildlife. And the thing is, Doris, our boat, is, she's so small. She's only 8.5 metres long, 29 foot. Like, Greg Rutherford's world record long jump is longer than Doris.
I love that Greg Rutherford could long jump over your boat.
Yeah, I know.
Awesome.
Yeah, I should give him a shout.
Yeah,
that.
You should.
Yeah. But the point being is that because she's so small, then actually you end up, the wildlife, I think, just totally accept her as if, like, we're in their environment.
Yeah.
And so the whales would come over and be really inquisitive. You know, they'd come from, like, miles off in the distance, and then they'd just come over to Doris and swim right next to you, under you, surface next to you, breach, like, about a couple hundred metres away.
Wow.
And then you had the birds. The birds were so cool. So these birds are called boobies.
Boobies!
Boobies! Words for to boobies. And they were, like, my favourite. Like, it was always a classic joke that I love the boobies.
Yeah.
Because they would come in and they'd land on the boat and they would swoop right next to your head, like, to the point where the feathers would hit you in the face. And then they'd land right next to you and they'd just hang out.
Yeah.
And then they'd, like, sidestep to get, like, a bit more of a stationary point on the boat.
Yeah.
And then they'd start, you know, just cleaning themselves. And the next minute they'd just tuck their head in and go off for a snooze for a wee while. And do you know what? One night that was really special was on Christmas Eve. This is me now. Obviously, being out in the ocean has made me in touch a bit more with my spiritual side, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
But this is so bizarre because we had loads of birds and each time there'd be maybe one, maximum two. But on Christmas Eve night, when I was, like, massively missing home, there were four boobies.
Four boobies!
Four boobies!
Quadra boobies!
Yeah. Four that all landed on the aft cabin where we slept. And then there was one, like, little, what was he called? Sooty Tern, I think it was, that landed on the bow. So it was kind of, in the way I saw it, was like, well, Sooty Tern was for Doris.
Yeah.
And then we had one little boobie each.
Yeah.
And it was, like, cute. And then the next day we had, when we celebrated Christmas Day, we had one boobie that hung out on the oar right next to us when we were eating our Christmas pud from my Auntie Mary.
Oh, I'm going to go read about boobies now.
Yeah, honestly.
So those are the most amazing times. What was the scariest moment out there? Because I remember reading Sarah Alton's book when she was getting smashed to bits on some reef somewhere and thinking, how do you even deal with that fear?
Yeah. No, I mean, Sarah, bless her, she's probably been through it. I mean, we... to a certain extent, are extremely lucky with the experiences we had that we didn't have anything to the extent that Sarah's had. You know, I mean,
yeah.
She has been.
Oh, it's like they're having a laugh, the weather gods, with Sarah, aren't they?
I know, bless her. She's been through the mill. I think for us, we did the first 24 hours, we went straight into quite a big storm that came in on the coast. So we were suddenly faced with, like, 40 foot, seas and stuff, which, of course, we hadn't been faced with that. Now, maybe later on, who knows, but that kind of, we may have been a bit more sort of blasé about those sorts of waves because we got used to it. But to go straight into that was fairly scary. And just, like, the waves crash right next to you and they just throw you off your seat. And any time that happens, you just literally, we just say to each other, hold on.
Oh,
it's
my,
like,
gosh.
Hold on.
Oh,
and
my.
Then you're thinking, like, crap, I'm going to go over. And then luckily, Doris was actually quite heavy, so she sat quite low in the water, and I think that was a blessing for us because it meant she'd never properly capsized.
Yeah.
So she got thrown up on about, you know, not quite 90 degrees, but she did get thrown up a couple of times.
Yeah.
But then just got shunted along, and I think because we sat low in the water, sat where she should have, we were 100% would have capsized plenty of time. But I think, to be honest, what I do say is my actual proper gut fear, like when I was massively reactive, was when I had a slight moment when I thought pirates were about to get on the boat. Now, in all seriousness, there's a backstory to this, which is why. I'll set the scene.
Okay.
So, a day before we were leaving Samoa, there were these two guys that were hanging out by the boat.
Yeah.
And they looked a bit sketchy. They didn't speak any English. And anyway, we found out later on that they were pirates. And I was like, oh, cash. didn't know you'd, as you do.
Yeah.
So I didn't know you'd get pirates over in Samoa, but anyway, thought that was, not Somalia. So that was one thing. We were driving through the town that night, and Tony was driving, and as we were going through, I saw these two guys, these two pirates. And I was like, what the heck are they carrying? Turns out they were carrying a flipping cow's head that was still dripping blood at the back, like literally as if they'd walked around the corner and just chopped it off. So I was like, okay, that's slightly dodgy and weird. And then we didn't see anything more of them. We left Samoa the next day, and as we're rowing out, and the next 24 hours, we kind of followed the land round before we could get out into the Pacific.
Yeah.
So as we're following it round, about sort of mid-afternoon, there was this old fishing boat that kind of came up in the distance, and I could see like two guys with hoodies up.
Yeah.
And they were just hovering, and I'd said to Nat then, I think because my back was up a little bit from the day before, just like, it feels really uncomfortable. I feel a bit vulnerable. Like we're suddenly, for once out of the whole row, did I feel like, you know what, we're four girls in a boat, bright pink boat.
Yeah.
What the hell have we got on this boat to do? So that started my mind like ticking. Then like 1 o'clock in the morning, and we could see this light every so often come on in the distance, and then it'd go off for ages. And I just thought it was like a car going around the headland or something. And then that was like, no, I think it might be a boat, mate. You know, I was like, no, why wouldn't they keep the boat? Why wouldn't they keep it on? Next minute, it was pitch black. The light had gone off, but you could suddenly hear this whirring of a boat engine. And I was like, holy crap, that is actually a boat. It's like, why the hell has he not got his light on? And the next minute, he turns it on, and the flipping boat was like right next to us. On top of that, there were like two guys in kayaks that came right next to our oars. And then there were like six guys in the water with snorkels and stuff and masks on.
What?
And I was just like, oh my God. It's like, Emma. So I like scream. The poor girls are in the cabin.
Yeah.
They're fast asleep. So I'm like screaming at them to get up. And I'm like, Emma, call Tony on the sat phone right now.
Yeah.
So she's like, what? And I'm like, yes, call Tony. So I'm like kicking off. Poor Meg has only just got on the boat, so she's never seen me like lose it. So she's like, whoa, what the hell is going on?
I'm like, crazy.
Yes. And meanwhile, when I sort of suddenly heard the boat, I'd like ripped back the hatch that was underneath me, and there was a flares box in there. I'd opened up the flares box and I pulled out a flare.
Yeah.
And I'd like carried, I had the flare in my hand as I carried on rowing. And then these guys that were in the water, I mean, I'm not joking, they were like between our oars, we were right in them. They were talking in like Samoan, and I couldn't understand anything. And then they sort of said, fish, you know, blah, 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 fish. And Matt was trying to say to me, mate, I think they're just fishing. I was like, it's the middle of the night. Why? And I'm like, what are you doing here? And then, of course, my mind had just gone off on one.
Yeah.
I'm like in a movie, and I'm like, oh, my God, they're distracting us. It's going to be other people, the other side of the boat. So I'm like, Nat, check the other side of the boat. I'm like, Meg, go out the back hatch. Make sure they're not holding onto the ropes. Meanwhile, I've got this flare in my hand. I'm about to shoot the sods if they came near, if they like went to climb on the boat. And I'm thinking, right, there's a knife to my left. I'm like, okay, I can take that oar out and I can hit them with the oar. So I'm like totally on like edge and on guard. And then we get Tony's on the sat phone. So Emma's like relaying the sort of story to him. He's like, yeah, mate, they're most probably just nighttime fishing. And then as
they're
like...
They're crapping themselves. They're like, there's this crazy white lady in a boat with a flare.
And there I was. I was like, oh my God, no, they're not fishing. And then a couple of minutes later, we've literally like rowed past them. And I think then that I realised, actually, I think we'd rowed through them rather than them approaching us. And then I was like, maybe I'll just put the flare back in the box. Just tighten that up a little back. Bit. And you guys go back to sleep. It's all fine.
Oh, my days.
Like, sorry, ladies.
I'm impressed with your reaction, though. It is amazing, isn't it, when you get into... Like, I've been in a couple of situations where you have to... Something dangerous is about to happen or is happening, and you just go instinct on it. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, massively.
This is part of... You learnt so much about the team. I mean, you were the team lead, but you learnt... From talking to you, you learnt so much about... what makes a good team and the importance of kind of diversity in it. And I know you've recently done a TED talk about it, but what did you learn about about how to put a team together and what's important to have in a team of people in such a close environment.
I just, yeah, it's made me massively realise that kind of don't see things through your own lens. Like, I used to very much see life as this one kind of, you know, impression, and like thought I knew what I'd need in a team, and that was going to be people that were like-minded and kind of had sort of physical sort of background in sport or whatever. I knew that they'd be dedicated, but actually, if everybody's the same, you're all going to have the same strengths, and that means usually you're going to have the same downfalls. Nobody's perfect, nobody is fully strengths without anything to work on, and so having that diversity massively kind of is what strengthens the team, and we had such mutual respect with each other.
Right, now I would love to talk about so much more of the row and of the boat, but I know there's a documentary coming out, so that's right, people can watch
there
that.
Is, yeah.
Let's go right to the end of the row. So you've been going
party time.
Woohoo! You've been going for 9 months. How many thousands of miles had you rowed?
Just over 9,000 miles.
9,000 miles. Yeah. How many world records were you on to break?
We set 2 world records.
And how do you feel when the boat hits land for the final time? Yeah. I'm getting a bit emotional thinking about it, and you all step out of that boat together.
Yeah, it's so special. Like, massively emotional, plus land legs, sea legs or whatever. Yeah. We all nearly wiped out. But no, it's just, I got quite emotional. Obviously, I'm emotional at that point, but even just before that, when we were rowing in, there were quite a few moments out at sea in that last leg that I was like, oh my God, this is coming to the end. This is it. Like, flipping heck, we've worked on this for like over 4.5 years, like, and now finally that we've actually set out, we've achieved what we set out to do. And it just, I would sometimes, when I was on that last leg, I'd sometimes start thinking that, and I was like, well, we haven't finished yet, so stop it, because until we literally get into the finish, that's when you can allow yourself to accept it.
Yeah,
so it was literally rowing in on that last little bit, that's when I got massively emotional. I was like, oh my God, this is so overwhelming. Like, this is it. We never have to row again. We never have to plan or organise any of this stuff again. The stress is gone. This is now party time. And it was just amazing. And the biggest thing is when, you know, we saw our parents and stuff standing on the pier as we rowed in. And that was the kind of the like switch that just got the tears going, because you just, it was that overwhelming feeling of like, oh, thank God we made it back safely for them, because no matter how supportive they were, obviously they were never going to relax until we got to land.
Yeah.
And you totally understand that. And as much as we knew we were fine out there, and as much as you say that to them on a sat phone or in an email, they're still going to worry about the unknown, aren't they? So yeah, so it's just great to just see their relief and just know that, yeah, I don't have to put you through that anymore.
Oh.
So yeah.
Now, last couple of questions. How on earth do you adjust back to normal life after? You mean, do you ever just sit at your desk one day and you're, because you're now back in the job you were in before?
Yes, yeah.
But which you love.
I do.
And do you ever just sit at your desk and think, I've rowed a freaking ocean? Not on that, I've rowed the biggest ocean. Like, do you ever, what goes through your head? Do you just?
It's weird, because I think all the way even leading up to the row, I've always kept work and row very segmented. Mm. So I never would talk about the row when I was at work, and vice versa. But then when I was out in the ocean, like, work was what I was always striving to get back for, because we were getting so delayed, and it was making me really worried about the fact that I might not have a job when I got back, and that, you know, one of my other dreams and passions was to be at Rio this year, and I thought that might not happen. And so for me, the kind of, I always wanted to have something to come back to anyway, so that post-expedition I didn't have a real drop-off, because I would have nothing to look forward to. So coming back into work, I was massively excited. I was like, yeah, let's go. And then everybody was like, okay, this is great. Tell us about the row. And no, don't rush into things. And I was like, no, I'm fine. Let's go. I'm good. Right, so we're the athletes. Like, I haven't seen anybody for a year. What's going on? And they're like, just come back in. Just ease yourself in. And yeah, bless them. I think I came back with a bit of a whirlwind. And then about a month into it, I massively had overcommitted myself and was like trying to contact everyone, email and phone call and visiting everyone. And I remember turning to my sports psych and going, I just don't understand it. I'm so tired. He's like, Laura, you've just been rowing for 9 months.
Yeah.
You've got back, and within 2 weeks, you're practically back full time at work, and you haven't stopped since.
Yeah.
And you've already been to Brazil and done X, Y, and Z with work within the first month. It's like, that's most probably why you're just emotionally, mentally, and just physically still very tired, and you just haven't rested yet. I was like, oh yeah, maybe.
sensible man. Yay. Damn the sensible people.
You're right, you do. Occasionally you get those moments just when you're sitting around in a meeting and maybe, you know, your head switches off and you drift off and you're just like, wow, this time last year I was like paddling about in the middle of the ocean. It's most probably a whale just jumping over the side. But no, I'm now in a meeting room talking about plans for Rio. How life changes.
So the final question, which I always ask people, but I think I'm going to put yours with a little twist, is a bit of advice. So normally it's advice for people who are scared about starting things. But with you, I think I'd really like your advice for people who perhaps have started things, but they're not going to plan and they're thinking of turning back and giving up.
Yeah.
What would be your advice for anyone that wants to get out there and take on something that seems insurmountable?
You've got to believe in it 110%, and that you've got to have a true reason to kind of why you're doing what you're doing, because when you're going to get tough times and dark times, and during those times that's when you need to be able to ask yourself the question of, well, you know what, ask yourself, what if? And if your what if I don't do this, how am I going to feel in the future having not ever done this in my life? And if your what if is, actually, if I quit this and I continue with my work, am I going to be happy with myself? Can I live with myself with that? For me, if I asked myself, what if I didn't do the row, every time I was like, I'm going to be gutted.
Yeah.
So I need to give it 110%. I need to make sure I've like left no stone unturned. And if at that point I still can't achieve it, well, then that's out of my control.
Mm.
But when it's in my control and it's something I can physically do about it, then I need to give it 110%. So give it your all, believe in what you sort of are setting out to do, and just hold true to the reasons that you that are close to you, and just go and get it.
Laura Penhall, you are a true adventure queen.
Nah,
let's go and eat some chicken.
Yes, Wagamama.
Wagamama. No boobies.
Yeah, boobies.